FM. This show is Good Morning Comrade. We have an interview today, very special, with Bruce McGee. He is a professor at Louisiana Tech University, and he's also one of the hosts of the Louisiana Anthology podcast. Talks a lot about Louisiana history, culture, and the like. So just going to get right to the interview. So this is Bruce McGee, myself, and Scott's in there a little bit. We talk about Huey Long and his approach and all the good stuff that comes with that. So you're really going to enjoy it.
So you want to talk about Huey Long today?
Yeah, a little bit, just because some stuff came up about it not long ago, about Huey Long and about how he, how he's sort of like held in a sort of very controversial light. And there's a lot of different ways that people, don't necessarily understand his approach to, up to politics and governance and all that other stuff.
Well, the thing you hear as soon as you get the word Huey Long out of your mouth and take a breath, what they will always say is corruption. Have you heard that from people?
Oh, yeah, all the time. All the time.
Right. Now, what do you mean by corruption? If you go back in classical literature, the classical definition of corruption comes from Aristotle, where you start putting your own good ahead of the good of the state or the good of the nation. And when you look at Huey Long, I mean, he wanted to do well himself, but every time he got power, who'd he use it for? He used it for the people.
Mm-hmm.
So the old Aristotelian sense, I was just rewatching to get ready for this, the Ken Burns documentary.
Oh, yeah.
Have you ever watched that?
Not the one on Huey Long. I watched some of the other ones.
It's one of those even-handed, let's watch both sides talk about him and let the people decide. And,
like as you would expect from PBS, right?
Yes. And, 30 years ago when I first saw it, I had a lot more patience for that kind of reporting. Mm-hmm. What was I saying?
You were talking about the PBS documentary of Huey Long.
Yeah, I can't remember why. Oh, I was rewatching it, yes, in about 20 minutes before the end, they mentioned that Roosevelt was very threatened by Long. And back in that day, when a president felt threatened by a rival, they sent the IRS after him. And so he had an extensive investigation done, and more than simply going through his records, they followed him around. So if he went in a shop and he got a shirt, they would send somebody in to make sure he had paid for it.
Sure.
So I think if he were corrupt in the sense they usually mean, he would have been caught pretty easily. And the stuff that's so outrageous to them, like the deduct box where supposedly if you worked, and I think this may be true, if you worked for the state in a patronage job in years where they had an election, he would deduct part of your salary and use that as his slush fund to run. But he wasn't a private slush fund to enrich himself.
Slush fund.
Yeah, and those kinds of funds were common at the time. So it's like when Trump this week, we're, at the beginning of the impeachment process when we record this, it turns out he's very worried about corruption carried out by Joe Biden and son Hunter. Well, its own children, of course, are raking in millions and perhaps billions of dollars in their own corrupt endeavors. And, you know, a lot of that stuff is not illegal in our system currently because, you know, we've got a corrupt system. But it's not extraordinary on the part of Huey Long. And I don't know if you ever listened to Michael Brooks' podcast.
Oh, yeah. I do.
The Michael Brooks Show, TMBS,
yeah.
Which I encourage you.
What kicked me off on this sort of, like, tangent, because I saw that you had responded to a post or you responded to an interview he did with Harvey Kay.
Yes.
When he wrote, like, Harvey Kay is a historian at, where's he at now?
I don't even know.
But he's up north, I think, like, Minnesota.
Okay.
A lot of, like labor history type stuff. And specifically, he talked about how, like, essentially in the side of, like, Roosevelt versus Long, he felt he came down pretty squarely on the Roosevelt side.
Right,
and,
because Long was so corrupt. And Michael has this kind of ongoing. He's one of the few media outlets in English that's covering Lava Jato, which means car wash in Portuguese, and the way that it's locked up the former president Lula.
Lula
Libre.
Yeah.
Which is, supposed corruption that they never really proved. There's no real proof, but they just kind of in a judicial coup locked him up.
Mm-hmm.
And then have this Bolsonaro who is literally burning the lungs of the planet down there in the Amazon. So the side that's locking you up, when they talk about corruption, it's a talking point. It's not a real thing in what we traditionally think of corruption, except we did have one guest on our podcast. I can't remember who it was. He said there's another meaning of corruption that the Southern white use, and that is corruption is when government services and money goes to minorities, people who aren't powerful.
Right. The reconstruction of the carpetbaggers.
Yeah. You know, and these aren't our people that are making money off of government anymore. So that's corruption. So in that sense, Huey Long, quote-unquote, corrupted the Louisiana government because he delivered services to ordinary people, both black and white. Anyway.
It serves as a good sort of intro to the topic.
Yeah.
What can you just describe maybe just some of the, like, where was Long from? What were some of the things that made him like rise up so quickly? What were some of the things that he pushed, and what were some of the policies that he implemented? To talk a little bit more clearly about the timeline.
Long is an ascetic genius, and he had the dates were 1893 to 1935. He was born in Winfield, which is one of the most radical parts of the state, at least back then. They didn't want to go into the Civil War. They thought it was a rich man's fight. It's piney woods, hills and bottoms, and not in a way of large mega farms like the plantations.
Right.
Instead, it was more working class people, and they weren't really into the Civil War. Later on, they were actively supportive of the socialists of the period, and William Jennings Bryant once said, every man a king, but no one wears a crown, and that became kind of the Huey Long mantra, right?
The cross gold speech guy.
Yeah, and I did a word search through the material we have, and by the way, I'm a co-editor of the Louisiana Anthology, as well as a co-host of the Louisiana Anthology podcast. And we probably have the most extensive amount of material by Huey Long in one place on the Internet. In fact, we recently posted his political autobiography, Every Man a King. And it is the only place on the Internet where you can get it for free, which seems outrageous, I know, but we're it. And a lot of his other stuff is available elsewhere, but that's only available on our website.
What's the website?
Look up Lugia Anthology. It's A-N-T-H-O-L-O-G-Y. It's got a very long URL, so that'll mm-hmm. take you there. With pretty much the whole first page.
right.
But if you check under L for, you know, long, you find all of the stuff we had. We just added a new each last night, in fact, which was another a share of every Mannequin address that he was, you know, speaking. He usually spoke over NBC nationwide. And there's some of these speeches that you can go back and find and download. Anyway, he grew up in this kind of radical environment, and that seems to have kind of affected the way he looked at politics. And I did, I did a word search of his material, and he never mentioned Marx.
Yeah.
I didn't
know. He'd actually bristle at those kinds of accusations if he was ever called like a socialist or a communist or whatever, right?
Well, he might have read it because he was a brilliant politician and knew that communism was kind of beyond the pale of what you could talk about and get real big in the United States. So he would instead quote the Bible because people pretend that they believe what the Bible says. And then, you know, he would quote William Jennings Bryan, and he would quote other people that, you know, had cachet. This is, in rhetoric, what they call, logos, but you're trying to find an argument that will appeal to your audience. Maybe pathos, like, what will appeal to my audience? If I stand up here and talk about commies, that's not going to get it, but he used terminology and arguments that ordinary people could understand. And to me, that, you know, that goes to his genius. He was what we think of as a regular kind of genius in that he remembered everything he read, just brilliant.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was able to read law, and he went to law school for about a year and then just read the rest of the book and passed the bar exam on the first try. That's the kind of intellectual brilliance, but that wouldn't have made him, that would not have lifted him up. You know, there are a lot of really smart people, people who make their way looking smart, you know, the Ezra Klein type, wonky. And he was not wonky. I mean, he had all the facts and figures at his fingertips, he understood people, and so his political tactics were brilliant. Just one example. When he came into office, there were very few paved roads in Louisiana.
Mm-hmm.
And there was very little money to pave roads. I think there were 300 miles of road. He had money that he could get out of the legislature to pave 60 miles of road that first year. Okay, so you're the governor of the great state of Louisiana. You want to put 60 miles of road where they will do the most good to get people to want to get more roads. Where do you put it?
Probably on the Capitol.
What's that?
Money to be transferred or products that need to be transferred to
the interstate.
Well, you want to be, yeah, where would you build your highway?
Like
in the state of Louisiana, you look at a map, where do I want that 60 miles of road?
Between, 60 miles. If you're, thinking from Baton Rouge or, from
looking Baton Rouge and New Orleans, you want to connect them?
Yes, exactly. That's what everybody always says, Baton Rouge. I do this for my class all the time. I'm going to build a road from Baton Rouge to New Orleans. That'll be great. No. That's what a smart person does. What a genius does is go all over the state, put in a couple of miles here and a couple of miles there, and just, you know, Monroe, Shreveport, Alexandria, Lake Charles, smaller towns. You put in at the edge of town, just a little bit of highway. And then what do? They ride on that little bit of highway, and then they pop off back into the mud. And then when they get home, what do?
they want the highway everywhere.
I want my highway, damn it, you know. And so that is genius, right?
Yeah, it's pretty brilliant.
So,
they essentially was able to predict, like, so giving a taste or whatever, and then, like, essentially encouraging public demand to go that direction. I mean,
I remember growing up, my family, immediate family, lived in Ruston, Louisiana, and a few times a year we would drive down to Collins, Mississippi, where the family, you know, extended family was. Every time we went, as I was growing up, there'd be a couple of more miles of interstate. You just, the day you got to go past Ravel without having to go through Ravel, that was a great day, right? And it's nothing against Ravel, it's just you're driving on this slow two-lane highway and all of a sudden, boom, you're zooming along 75. So I personally experienced, you know, why that kind of road building is so popular, because little by little you see it going up.
You are listening to WHIV 102.3 FM. This is our interview with Bruce McGee. Bruce is a professor at Louisiana Tech University, and he is talking to us about Huey Long. So here we go.
Okay. And so you did that as governor, yes?
Right.
Okay. So how did he get into the position to become, like, a popular politician and become governor?
He was too young to run for most offices. And, immediately after he got his law degree, he started practicing law. But he was already, like, bent on becoming a politician. So one thing he made sure was that he never sued a little guy. Like, he only went against big people on behalf of the little people.
The little people don't have anything either.
Yeah, right. They couldn't pay him that much. He might get something out of, settlement. Lawyers get their fee from what you settle for, but they couldn't pay him his way, right? But he wanted to be known as, because he knew, Kamala Harris, one thing that kind of did in her presidential run was she was locking up parents of sick kids for not having them in school. It made her look really, really bad, and there's no defense for that.
He laughed about it. Anyway, I have to get dragged into this, but yeah.
So he became he ran to serve on the Louisiana Railroad Commission because they didn't have a lower age limit. How old was he? 1918.
He's still a kid.
Yeah, still very young. He was born in 1893. So what, 25, something like that? I'm not very good at mental math. That kind of commission would cover other things besides just railroads. So he made sure that he used his job as a regulator to try to regulate on behalf of the little guy. I'm not sure if this happened when he was on that commission. Maybe. The phone company raised the price of a phone call.
No.
And Huey Long pushed through a regulation rolling it back to 5 cents. I am actually old enough, Jeff, to remember being able to make a 5 cent phone call from a phone booth in Louisiana. So it was still in place 30 years later.
Phone booth?
Ha, It's where Superman used to change.
My dad was a payphone guy.
My dad actually did work on payphones a long time ago. Like he was the last payphone guy.
Yeah. He was the last cowboy.
Wow. Hey, has somebody else joined us?
I'm Jeff's brother.
Oh, hey, Jeff. Jeff's brother, Scott.
Yeah.
Nice to meet you. So anyway, he tried to use that position to maximize both what he could do for people, but also burnish his own image in the state. And he was able to get enough attention that he was able to run for governor. He ran in 1924. I think he lost.
24.
And he thought rain turned the roads in North Louisiana into mud that day, and he blamed that for his loss, and who knows. But anyway, 1928, he runs for the governor, and so that puts him it was a thing of the times matching the man. Like, you know, Bernie has been preaching the same thing for 30 years. So why is he popular now? It's because in the class war of the 1% against the rest of us, to use more modern terminology, they're winning, right? And the wealth gap is getting huger and huger. So that was happening at this time, too. And then when the Depression hit, it really hit the poor people hard. And so he was in a place to do things about the Depression. For one thing, there was this there were these runs on the banks, and banks would everybody would take their money out, and the bank would close. And there was a rumor about a bank across the state, I think maybe Lafayette. Jumps in his car, has his driver drive him there, and he's the first guy in line when everybody's rushing to the bank to take their money out. Before the bank opens, he turns around and addresses the crowd and says, if we take our money out, the bank's going to go broke and it'll hurt everybody else. And, well, we want our money. And he said, well, it happens that the state of Louisiana has a giant deposit in this bank, and if y'all take your money out, I'm going to take our money out first and nobody else will get anything. So they all went home.
Yeah, it's like the madman with the finger on the explosives.
Yes, right. I'll blow it up first, and none of you get anything. Whereas if you go home and let this bank stay open, everybody will eventually be able to get your money out. And it was hard, you know. I mean, there were other things he would do. And, you know, this kind of stuff, in that case, probably everybody liked it because he was saving banks. But most of the time, the rich people really reacted pretty violently to what he was doing. If you watch the beginning of that Huey Long documentary by Ken Burns, and show all these people, North Louisiana, South Louisiana, black, white, New Orleans, they're all saying, everybody loved Huey Long. We all loved Huey Long because he did stuff for the poor man. We were poor. Then they have switched to Mrs. Hodding Carter. Now, do you know who Mrs. Hodding Carter was?
Nope.
Well, they're relatives of Jimmy Carter and part of the Louisiana elite, or Southern elite, right? And Hodding Carter, I think it was Junior, was a newspaper man, I believe in Hammond. He kind of led the progressive, well, they call themselves liberal, right? And they were part of the Roosevelt New Deal type. But, man, they just hated Huey Long with a purple passion. I mean, you can see something of that in the whole Bernie versus Liz Warren kerfuffle right now. Like, Liz Warren is more of your traditional Roosevelt. I'm trying to save capitalism, right, by sanding off some of the rough edges. And then you get a rabble-rouser like Huey or Bernie that comes along and says, we need to tear this down. And they just really reacted to it. And she would come on there and talk about how everybody she knew hated Huey Long. When I heard the news over the radio that a man in a white suit had shot Huey Long, I rushed downstairs to see if Harding was still in the house.
Right.
Because it just could have been Harding that went off and shot him, because he talked about it all the time. I was down there talking to Harding, and the phone rang. It was Harding's mother, and she said, where is Harding? And I said, he's okay, so I got to get off the phone and see if I can find my daddy. the power structure really hated you, because it was really the first time, other than Reconstruction, the only time in Louisiana that Louisiana had done things for people who weren't rich, white, mm-hmm. and powerful. And government was to be government by them, of them, and for them. And most of the time, your demagogic types, your rabble-rousers, they would preach against black people and then make a deal with the rich, you know, like George Wallace, if you remember. Mm-hmm. If you learned about him. And how old are you, Jeff?
I am 35.
Okay, so you're a little young to remember personally George Wallace.
I've read on him quite a bit. I've read some of, I agree with Rick Perlstein's books.
Mm-hmm.
I read some of his stuff. The series on, like, Goldwater. And
right, and the traditional Southern demagogue will harangue the crowd in a way that's similar to TV, but then they make the problem is the brown people or the black people or the immigrants,
mm-hmm.
and they're the reason you aren't getting money. And if you look in their pockets, they don't have any money either, and Huey would direct the attention of the people to the source of the problem, which is we're the richest country in the world, and all the wealth is in the hands of a very few people.
Right.
Which, kind of attracted some of the fascists in the country, because we talk about Mr. Rockefeller and Mr. Baruch and, Baruch is a very Jewish name. So if you don't like Jewish people because you're a fascist, then the stuff Huey's saying sounds pretty good to you. But he didn't attack them for being Jewish. He attacked them for having all the money.
And right,
you're
which is
to
a different thing.
LP New Orleans,
right.
2.3.
You know, we got to get some of the money back
good morning,
for the remainder
comrade.
Of people.
This is my and Scott's interview. Forgot it was in it. This is our interview with Bruce McGee. Bruce is a professor at Louisiana Tech University, and we are talking about Huey Long. So here we go.
You have a really great speech on that. I think it's worth kind of taking a second to get into. So you talk about the big barbecue.
Yes.
The big barbecue speech. Can you describe that really quickly?
Yeah, and the first thing to notice about that is he did it in a Senate hearing room rather than on the Senate floor. He had it packed with staffers and just whoever wanted the hearing speak rather than speaking to the other senators. And then the question you want to ask yourself, goes to the genius, right? Why is he giving the speech there and not on the Senate floor? And in the 1930s, at the time, what was said in the Senate stayed in the Senate. They didn't record
No C-SPAN.
No C-SPAN, no voice recording, no video recording, no nothing. You go into the Senate, and I'm at the Senate. I'm Huey Long at the Senate. I'm Senator Huey Long at the Senate giving this speech to people that look kind of like senators. And so as far as anybody who's watching that across the nation and a newsreel is concerned, it's a Senate speech, but they can watch it. And it's the only Senate speech they can watch because he's brilliant, you know. He's going to use that platform. So anyway, in the speech, he says, what if somebody gave a barbecue and everybody's putting stuff out on the table? There's plenty of chicken, plenty of roast or ribs, you know, all this good food. And then here come Mr. Baruch and Mr. Rockefeller, and they take 85% of the barbecue off the table.
Mm-hmm.
And what are you going to do? You're going to say, come back here and put some of that grub back on the table.
Right.
And,
and he did it, and what's really funny about that part, too, is that he switches from sort of like a standard, like very bombastic, but like sort of conventional rhetorical style. And then he sort of slips into, like, really fast talking, like, Southern Louisiana talk.
Yes, and, you know, he was able to code switch, they call it now, but if he went to speak to LSU to a bunch of, he could use perfect English. But he could also speak on the level, and, you know, you're common, ordinary American, put some of that grub back on the table. That makes sense. In fact, this makes a great class exercise. I have brought 10 cookies to class, and I had 10 students sit up at the front, and then I distributed it after we watched the speech.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, like 5 cookies go to the first kid, and then the second kid gets a cookie. Well, you know, by the time you get through the first 3 people, you're out of cookies.
Right.
Nobody else gets anything. And it's just a very graphic presentation of how we divide up the wealth of the richest world in the country in America today. And they're sitting here looking at these piles of cookies. And so then he says, you know, he had $100 million wealth cap? Michael Brooks says every billionaire is a failure of policy because you've taken the wealth away from the people that created it and put it in one person's pocket.
Right. It goes from workers to bosses, essentially.
Right. Yeah, the capitalists suck up the profit, and there's none left for everybody. I mean, he wouldn't use that terminology, but he was talking about that in worker alienation. He's saying we need a wealth cap, take away Liz Warren. They, you know, who's that guy that ran Starbucks that wants to run
Howard for president? Schultz.
Yeah, he wanted to run for president because Liz Warren came out in favor of a 2% wealth tax.
Right, which is, huge. Like, to him, that's nickels.
Yeah, right. It's nickels on the dollar. So for every dollar he had over, you know, 100 million or a billion or wherever she set her limit.
He still could have seen wealth. But you will get 2% less.
Which
turns out to be a fairly, like, sizable amount of money in the long run, but, like,
it's
proportionate to the entire balance. But in terms of the balance of the money that the billionaire has, they have 98% of it.
Well, Huey Long did not want there to be billionaires whatsoever, or once you hit $100 billion, his plan was to take everything. Every yacht, every jet, and all that. He would ask his audiences, how many of you own 4 suits? And nobody would raise their hand. How many of you own 3 suits? Nobody would raise their hand. And 2 suits? Nobody would raise their hand. And Mr. Rockefeller has 100 suits. We need to get those back. And so he said, give them enough money to live their life and be perfectly comfortable, and their kids have a perfectly comfortable life, and their kids' kids, let them have their mansion, let them have a yacht, let them have another wife if they want another wife. But after they've, you know, taken all they can eat.
Not the wokest thing.
Well, you know, after they've eaten all, after they've taken all they need and all their kids need,
everybody
and all
gets,
their kids' kids, tell them to come back and put some of that on the table for the remainder of the people. And that's where he started the Share Our Wealth Club,
mm-hmm.
which to me, I think the DSA is kind of picking up mm-hmm. where the Share Our Wealth Club's left off. After he was assassinated, they just kind of died on the vine. And we really haven't had an organization in the country, a significant one, that was trying to do something about the wealth gap. And maybe from his time, or, you know, I guess World War II blew away a lot of that. And are you now, or have you ever been a communist that blew a lot of it? You know,
Red Scare kind of, stuff.
Yeah, it destroyed the left in our country, and it didn't get a real reboot economically. You know, he had Martin Luther King. At the end, he was starting to preach economics. He got killed.
Right.
Before he had time to push it very far.
When he was organizing garbage workers in Tennessee to get a poor people campaign nationally.
Union, man. So they struck him down. But I think when it got its modern reboot, you probably are old enough to remember this, was the Occupy movement.
I remember the Occupy movement.
And
And let's not forget Jesse Jackson and the Rainbow Coalition.
Yeah, right. He was good. But people kind of laughed at him. You know, first they laugh. What's the rest of the saying?
Like first they laugh, then they, you know, hate you, then they fear you, then you win, or something like that.
Yeah.
One of those kinds of things.
First they ignore you, then they laugh at you.
Then they fear you, then you win.
Right. Then they fight. And yeah, that was from Gandhi. So anyway, Jesse, he was coming along, though. I mean, the Democratic, and this is why we need something like the DSA or Occupy or Share Our Wealth.
So I was just going to make like one quick distinction too, and this can sort of lead into the way that Long himself made decisions. One of the critiques that many people have of Occupy is that it was a sort of like a group of people that were, and this might be a broad generalization too, it might be an overgeneralization, but the idea was that they really struggled in terms of developing structures that would create consensus or create, like, be able to make decisions because they based their entire structure for decision-making on front-end consensus instead of having a kind of structures or process to make those decisions.
Yeah, I think it was a very top-down organization because when Huey died, they died. I'm hoping that what Bernie has done will live beyond him.
You mean Huey Long's organization?
I mean, he did at least have the knowledge that you weren't going to change the country from the inside. He didn't go into the Senate and say, I'm going to go along and get along. He went around the room saying, the kingfish is here, boys. And he was telling, one time, he's famous for telling the Senate that not too long from now, the people of this country are going to be coming up here to hang you guys from the rafters.
Yeah.
I've got to decide whether I'm going to be in here helping defend you or out there leading. Well, in fact, the Senate didn't think that was a very funny joke. But, in fact, he was leading them, right? That was the whole point of the Share Our Wealth movement, was to get a lot of people in his pocket so that he could go to powerful folks and say, you can deal with me or you can deal with them. And they're coming for you if you don't do what they say. And that really scares the, the power structure. The thing about Roosevelt, he was a rich guy trying to save the wealthy from winding up like the French and the Russians.
Right. That's a fundamental difference in their approaches because Roosevelt came from the sort of the elite of New York City,
right,
which is the tip top of everything, and Huey Long came from working class Louisiana.
Yeah, and His family was fairly well-to-do. He talked about a log cabin, but if you've seen pictures of the house, it's a very nice house for the
family. A nice cabin.
But, yeah, a very nice cabin. But he represented those people. He was a tribune of the people.
Mm-hmm.
And like the Gracchi brothers, he was eventually assassinated for that.
Right. So before we get to that, can we talk a little bit about some of the... I mean, they're sort of viewed as antics, but they could also be known as sort of like bypasses for the ways that decisions might be made in the Congress. So the Louisiana State University Tiger Stadium comes to mind for that.
Yeah, that's a favorite.
And
that's a favorite of mine because I had an office there when I was first a grad student. So, yeah, back in the 30s, he was wanting LSU to have a great football team. To have a great football team, you've got to have a great stadium. And the legislature wouldn't give him money for a stadium, so he asked, what will they give me money for? And they said, well, dorms. So he built a horseshoe of dorms and then put bleachers up over the dorm. And in the 80s, they had just closed those dorms as dorms. They had actually functioned as dorms. They had put like people that had very low status, like graduate students in English. And those rooms still had beds in them. There were showers. It was like the creepiest place to have an office ever. another thing he did.
Really quick.
Yeah, go ahead.
He built the dorms in such a way that they encircled a ground that is large enough to be a football field.
Right. And then he put the bleachers on. Because the bleachers themselves don't cost that much. You know, they're just steps and benches. But he laid them over that. Another famous thing he did was give textbooks to school students.
Yeah, across the state.
Right, free textbooks. And, you know, the thing that the mantra of the right wing is there's no such thing as free. We can't do this. But Mrs. Harding Carter was very, she liked the idea of giving those poor children textbooks. But the way he went about doing it was just such a dictator. So here's the way he went about doing it. He passes a law, free textbooks.
And this is what he ran on the first time for governor, right?
Yeah, right. And they word came back from Caddo Parish, Bloody Caddo, one of the most backward areas in the state, was Shreveport, very conservative. And word came back, Shreveport doesn't need the charity of the state of Louisiana. Our kids want to pay for their books. You remember that Paul Ryan, the kids want to pay for their lunch?
Right, yeah, because kids are working for the money that they're getting for lunch.
Right, so it's bullshit. They just didn't want black kids and poor white kids to go to school. Louisiana had a very high rate of illiteracy. So anyway, not too long after that, the United States Army came knocking on the door of Shreveport, and they wanted to put an Army airfield there, which is now Barksdale Air Force Base, one of the biggest Air Force bases in the country, and a constant supply of money for the local community. So it's visions of, but the problem was that part of the land needed for the airfield belonged to the state of Louisiana. So off they go to Baton Rouge. With sugar plums dancing in their heads, we need this field so we can build the Army air base, and then we'll have all this money coming in. And Huey tells them, Shreveport doesn't need the charity of the state of Louisiana. And that was when the local burghers broke. They said, okay, if you'll let us have this airfield, which will make us a lot of money, right?
Right.
Individually, they're business people.
We'll also take the free books, too.
Yes. God damn it, we'll take those free books.
We'll take the free books and the airfield for us.
This show is Good Morning, Comrade. You are listening to my interview with Bruce McGee. He is a professor at the Louisiana Tech University. which is up in Ruston. We are talking about Huey Long. This is going to be our last little segment for this hour, but we will have some more posted on our website. So check it out. Get some more information at goodmorningcomrade.com. Here we go.
This is kind of, I'm locally rather infamous for taking after right-wingers. And one of my favorite things to do is everybody loves their own socialism, right? So
right.
I start complaining about socialism, and I say, well, how about you stay off my road? What kind of school did you go to? Was it a public school? Was it a socialist school?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they'll have this little thing praising the troops. Well, you know the troops are socialists, right?
Right. We pay for that.
Yeah. They're classic socialism of no
State
matter
funded
how.
Army.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
There's no free market there.
And you know, I was telling a guy I went to high school with just the other day. He was complaining about stuff. And he said, you know where your water comes from, right? It's municipal water. That means it's owned by the city. And since water is 60% of your body, that means you're 60% socialist just to start off with. What, are you trying to turn us into Venezuela? And, you know, because socialism, there are elements of socialism scattered throughout our life.
Right. It's just that we don't. They've become sort of either naturalized or invisibilized.
Or we pay for it. Well, I pay
right.
taxes for that, or I pay for Social Security and Medicare. Yeah, in a sense, you did. In a sense, through you, because that's what the Republicans want to do is take that away, even though
the money they're trying to get in. Yeah. They want to like privatize Medicare
yeah.
or something, or they want to like make it so that there can be like speculation that's done or decisions that are made or like essentially turning and I talk about this fairly frequently about
yeah.
sort of like the paralyzing anti-politics of choice.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's sort of like a sense that like if you're given choices, that's necessarily a good thing, and the person will have all of those choices and make the best choice for themselves because they know everything about the situation that's in front of them because everybody has to be an expert.
Well, and look at the way that anti-unionism works. It's all with that rhetoric, right?
Mm-hmm.
You want them to have freedom of choice to decide whether to join the union or not. Well, if I own stock in this company, they don't ask me whether I'm going to support them pushing, you know, spending $1 million on Donald Trump.
Right.
And that's not a part of it. You know, you just, if you want to own stock, you got to put up with that. I'm thinking we should, you know, I've been thinking about unions. And if in an ideal world, union membership would be automatically universal.
A virtue of working.
Every job should come with a union. And if you want to have the company pay the dues for on behalf of the workers, fine.
It's the contradiction. If the labor that the workers are doing is creating the value anyway,
yeah.
Essentially, yeah. It's basically money that's like passing to the boss and then back to the workers.
Right, right. The money the boss has comes from the workers anyway. So let's set up unions. And, I mean, it would be a governance nightmare, but you need something like that for people to be able to have a, you know, a part in the economy. And look at, you know, like Uber.
Mm-hmm.
All these people working for us are private contractors. So that's
employees.
Yeah. What was that?
I said they're driving on our roads, too.
They are.
I
mean, you're familiar with the enclosure movement in England, and basically putting Uber on public roads is kind of like that. You know, how many people are making their money by the roads? So we have
everybody.
Interest.
I mean, it's
impossible.
I mean, every person who goes to work or goes to, you know, to market and buys or sells goods, or anybody who goes to a friend's house and, you know, socializes with them. They like all, like so many things are possible with roads and without
and
those
when,
roads. Without
when
those,
people,
people
are always whining about, well, look at how people are spending this SNAP, and they've got lobster, and lobster, I say, which I've never seen somebody with a SNAP card buying lobster in my life.
It'd be cool if they could. It'd be so cool if they could.
So I say, well, you're driving on my public road with your groceries. I want to see what you're buying for the money I spend on roads. And, you ever have steak in there? Do you, you know, because, and guess what? The same government that makes SNAP money makes the regular money.
Right.
You know, United States currency is a socialist product made solely by the mint. You know, if you make your own money, you get arrested and go to jail. You're making government money. So, if you start looking a little more closely, these talking points just kind of dissolve.
Yeah. So that's long.
Yeah.
So some more. Let's talk a little bit more about. Well, I guess we can move on to the sort of network of patronage and its manner of sort of dealing. Well, we alluded to it a little bit earlier, but how he sort of dealt with many of the adversaries that he would meet and the network of patronage they created.
He would make sure that, like, you know, Republicans are ruthless like this. If, you know, Puerto Rico has a disaster in their American citizens, well, they didn't help elect Trump, so they didn't get much in the way of a bailout, right?
Right.
Well, Long was a hardball politician, and so if you opposed roads in your community, well, guess what? Your community didn't get the road. And when people would complain about it, he would still talk to your politician, and either the politician would change or they would change politicians when the next election came around. And pretty soon, you know, he was spending all this money that everybody wanted. I mean, Dr. Weiss, if he indeed did kill Long, there's some debate about it. But the reason he went there was it was either his father and father-in-law had lost a patronage job. That was what he wanted to talk about was, you know, they needed their government paycheck back.
Right.
But everybody did that. We talked to... There's a Louisiana conservationist named Carolyn Dorman.
Mm-hmm.
And early in her career, she was a teacher. And this was before Long, like, you know, the early teens. And when a new governor came in, all the teachers lost their jobs. And new teachers were appointed who supported the new guy. Imagine patronage coming down to that level. So you're in the middle of your school year, and, after Christmas, you've got to move out because they've got to. So, yeah, I don't like political patronage all that much, but that was the water they swam in. You know, he was.
That's how political systems function to this day.
Yeah, totally. I mean, look at why one of the things it's turning out about the Bidens, you know, and Hunter Biden in his quote-unquote corruption. Well, who's that lawyer for the president? Used to be mayor of New York.
Rudolph Giuliani.
Yeah, Rudy. He was trying to put his own people on that board so they could get that money from being on the board of a big oil company. And so in order to make room for his people, I mean, it's, you know, a case of doing bad by while doing evil. We have a pretext to attack Biden, but also we get our people to patronize.
Right. They just want to what they want to see. You know, they want to really talk about, oh, well, I don't want to talk about Biden. I want to talk about what Trump's doing or whatever. And it's essentially just playing your side.
Well, there is a corrupt duopoly. You know, I mean, obviously one side is fascist and the other wants to give you health care, but there is still a certain level of ambient corruption. And that's kind of what did Hillary in. You know, they made a choice when Bill left the White House. We're going to get all the money we can get. And we're going to do it well out in public. It was all legal. But it looks bad. You know, I'm giving speeches to the big banks, making $500,000. How much is she going to take after the banks when she gets in? I mean, you know, Barack Obama. People called him a socialist the whole time he was in. He was a king of moderates. And the biggest contributor to his initial election, when it became clear he was going to win, he got $3 million for the banks.
Right. And he was a generationally talented politician. He had the ability to portray himself as something that he wasn't.
Right. And if you listened closely, he was never about, you know, storming the Bastille. It was all, let's hold hands, blue America, red America, getting along, getting our feet wet, snouts in the trough. But he wound up giving trillions of dollars to banks while grandma was getting thrown out of her house because she had been defrauded by the banker. No banker has ever gone to jail. Well, that is a marvelous return on investment for your
rich
bankers.
Right. Yeah. They just make money because they get there in those positions. Anyway, so how did this apply to Long?
Oh, well, you know, he gave his people money.
He's not remarkable, is what you're saying.
What's that?
He's not remarkable in that
sense. He did what every other American politician has done going all the way back. The idea of civil service, that you and I would have our job. We both worked for the state, which, by the way, folks, that makes us socialists, right? It doesn't matter what you preach. What we practice is socialism. I mean, you get paid by tax money, right?
Yeah, by the tax money of, I guess, a combination of things, right? But
right.
Mostly local property taxes.
Right, and I pay, me too. I get paid, some money, a little bit is still coming from the state. You know what else is a tax? Tuition, and we've raised tuition a lot on our kids.
Tickets.
All right, folks, so that's going to have to do it for this
episode
of
it's
Good Morning Comrade. You can listen
to
us every Tuesday on WHIV FM 102.3 or anywhere online on whivfm.org/listen. We also have more information at our website, goodmorningcomrade.com, where you can get a little bit of our extra feed. That's going to have the conclusion of this interview with Bruce McGee. We talk a little bit more about sort of Long structures and how should we look at Huey Long's legacy. So thanks a lot to Bruce. Check out his podcast, the Louisiana Anthology Podcast. You can get information for that at Louisiana on iTunes and Stitcher and all the podcast things, Louisiana Anthology Podcast. So thanks, y'all. We'll see you next week, and love you. Bye.